And we define that by R prime. This is the one particle density matrix rho R. And this is defined as psi dagger R prime psi R. Okay, so these psi's now, sometimes I use it for a wave function. Here these are field operators, which are destroying a particle at site I and creating a particle at site R prime. And you can look at this matrix element in the ground state of the system. Or you can also define this quantity at any finite temperature by taking a thermal average. Okay, so this is a general definition, so let me just write definition valid at any T. But for today's discussion, I'm going to just assume that I'm looking at zero temperature and I'm evaluating this correlation function in the ground, n-body ground state of bosons. So if I just go to Fourier space, this is going to be 1 over omega sum over k e to the I k dot r minus r prime. This is just nk. You see that I don't have k not equal to k prime, because I'm going from some state, initial state, which is the ground state. I generate some, I destroy some momentum, I must add that same momentum back to return to the ground state, right? So I can't have processes with where k and these two momenta are different. So in other words, this density matrix is nothing but the Fourier transform of the momentum distribution function. Okay, so what are we trying to do? What we are trying to do is, in momentum space, we saw a certain structure in n of k. What we are trying to understand is, what does that structure imply in real space? What kinds of correlations does it generate in real space in that wave function? So we want to visualize that. Like in the spin case, it's very clear. You look at a spin up, and you want to ask, if I go a distance r away from that spin, what is the probability I will still find that distant spin to have the same orientation? And that gives an idea about long-range order. Now you're asking that same question, but in this situation. And what we are going to do is connect this correlation function with the structure we already deduced for the momentum distribution. Momentum distribution that I have for a BEC, which is n of k. So for a BEC, n of k is equal to n0 delta k plus some regular piece. And this is the singular piece. So I substitute this form of n of k in that Fourier transform, and what you find is psi dagger of r, psi of r prime at long distances
it will be dominated by this behavior, by the short k behavior, and it will be a constant equal to this. Okay, so what we have seen is that the delta function in momentum space has generated some correlations in real space between these operators. So the amplitude to destroy a particle at r prime is correlated with the amplitude to create a particle at r. Okay, and exactly what is that correlation? We will now try to unearth that. So just for completeness, let me say that if this correlator, and I'm just going to write it, I'm suppressing all these vectors and so on. If this correlator went like e to the minus r prime over c, then we would call it normal or disordered. And if it went like a power law to some power alpha, then this is called algebraic. And that can happen at a critical point. So this can happen at a critical point. And it can also happen due to vortices in the Costeletz-Thouless phase transition. Not just at the transition, but in the entire phase. So we will talk about that tomorrow. I will discuss vortices, and we will see this algebraic effect. But for now, let's go on after this question about exactly what does it mean for this correlation function to have a non-zero value, a finite value at large distances. So let me, similar to the spin story, let us ask the question, can we write psi dagger r prime as can we write this? Right? And the first problem that we run into is that it's not sensible to write this kind of an expectation value for a ground state with fixed number of particles. So of something like, you know, where this expectation value is something like phi zero of n. Right? This is obviously equal to zero. Right? Because I'm going to create one more particle, and that has no overlap with the n plus one particle system and the n particle system, the overlap is zero. So if I have a system with fixed number of particles, then this is obviously not sensible. So we have to think about a grand canonical ensemble. So we must think about a grand canonical ensemble in which I can break up my volume into pieces. And And let's say I have a cell here which I'm going to label by I, and another cell here which I'm labeling by J. Okay, so I take a large volume and I divide it up into some pieces. Divide into, say, M cells, and I label the cells by I going from 1 to M. And in this cell, I'm going to define the creation operator. So let me say A0 dagger. Okay, this is somewhat subtle, these arguments, but they are very important to extract what we mean by the BEC in terms of another variable. We have seen it in terms of the condensate, but it really has much deeper structure. So I define it as this. AI0 dagger. Okay, so this is the operator for the full system. It's just my bosonic operator for the full system. And this is the operator I'm defining within the ith cell. Okay, and similarly, I can do this for the destruction operator, 1 over root m, sum over I from 1 to m, AI0. And these root m's are mandated by commutation relations. Okay, now if I look at N0, which is A0 dagger, I'm sorry, it's A0 dagger A0 by definition. This is 1 over m. I will get a term which basically will describe the correlations within a cell, and then I will have intercell connections. So I will get 1 over m, sum over I going from 1 to m, AI0 dagger, AI0. Plus a term I not equal to J, AI0 dagger, AJ0. These are somewhat subtle arguments, so you can think more about it. But let me at least get across the spirit of the argument. Okay, so this term here is going to be N0 divided by M. This, the first term. And then the second term will be 1 over m, sum over I not equal to j, AI0 dagger, AJ0. And what I want to emphasize is that this term, the left-hand side, is macroscopic. M is large. M is much, much greater than 1. So this term is sort of small. It's small compared to the left-hand side. So what you're seeing is that most of the contribution is going to come from this intercell connections. So in other words, sum over I not equal to J, this term must be of order n times m. Yes.
Are you integrating on each square? Are you taking the original fields and integrating them over each?
In this part?
Yeah.
Yeah, at this point, what I'm doing is I'm saying that I have my field operators, and I'm only adding up the field operators within. So for defining the big A, I just add up the field operators in the entire. So I have the little A at each site. Now I take those field operators at each site and integrate over a cell. And that's what I call little a sub I. It's the field operator in the cell. Okay, now I can, so essentially what I'm trying to do is this. I have my BEC, I'm breaking it up into little pieces. And I'm looking at the Bose condensate in each piece and asking, what does it look like within a cell? So within each cell, there is some condensate, which has this much density within each cell. So clearly, that is just a local condensate. But then, in order to get a term of order N0, I must have this order parameter between cells also contribute in such a way, in a very large way, to give me a term of order N. So the point of this is to emphasize that the BEC is not just condensate, local, a collection of local condensates. It's more than that. There is some intercell connection that also has to play a major role to give us a macroscopic density. Yeah.
Are those AI0? Are they like, do they have labels that are in real space and K space? Like the I,
no.
I cell.
Yeah. This is the K label.
Okay. So it's like the condensate is localized. I mean, in the I, that AI0 is like the creation operator for a local sort of.
Yeah. So as I said, it is a coarse grain variable on the scale of the cell. Is that clear?
So in some sense, they have like both position, like momentum and coordinate indices.
Yeah. So if I go back to my original variables, right? Suppose I had not coarse grained, then I could have said, well, let me just look at this, the creation operators, in a certain momentum state. But I'm looking. So are you concerned about my using both space and momentum? Yeah. Okay, so what I'm saying is this, that suppose I had taken these field operators, so let's say A of R, right? This is just my field operator at site I, and I had coarse-grained it over R belonging to the I itself, right? Then I would get, then I can define that operator to be A of I.
So this operator A, is it operator psi? This AR?
Yeah. So I mean, this and this are identical. So some, I might write it as psi I, or I might write, so A's and psi's are being used interchangeably. So here, this is R. Belongs to the I itself. This is my same as psi r. I coarse grain it on the scale of psi, and then I'm calling this A sub I. Okay.
But why does it also have momentum indices then?
So then, in it would have. So I'm now looking at. So let me think how I want to explain that. Okay. What I'm thinking of are, or each system is a macro system to begin with. So I cannot really be talking about Bose condensation in a system where the number is finite. That's the lesson we learned there, right? So just go back to what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to look at this field operator psi and ask what is its expectation value. That's what I'm trying to do. Now what you see is that in a system with finite n, I cannot define that quantity. So what I do is I make these little subsystems. In each subsystem, I can define this expression because in the subsystem, my number is not fixed, it is fluctuating, right? But is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
In each subsystem, the number is fluctuating. Is that clear? Okay. So once I have the number fluctuating in each subsystem, that becomes my condensate in the subsystem. Is that clear? Now I'm trying to ask, so the subsystem condensate is described by this, AI0. So it's a little subtle, so we have to do this slowly, and I'm glad you're asking me these questions. So here is the point. So in each subsystem, I have been able to define psi of r. Yeah. Is everybody with me on that? Because psi of r is what? Psi of r says, I look at this operator, and I look at phi 0 n plus 1. N minus 1. And I do this on the ith cell. Okay? So I'm using A's there, size, yes, I'm going to try to be consistent. Here what I'm doing is, let's break the system up into cells. And in each cell, I evaluate psi of r. Now there's no problem, because within the cell, particles are fluctuating. And this operator is non-zero if I had a BEC. And what would be the magnitude of this? Well, it would count the number of particles which are in the Bose condensate. And that would be how much? It would be N0 over N. Because in this cell, the total condensate in the entire system is N0. The number of particles in this particular cell is N0 over N. And this correlator is square root of that.
Excuse me, what has formally changed? Like, we had the average of psi equal to 0. Then we say that now it is not equal to 0, but the operator is the same. Like, we changed the state over which we are averaging.
Yes, because the average of psi over the full system, which has a fixed number of particles, is 0.
Yeah, it's not physically, but like how we obtain it formally. Like what has changed in the expression formally?
So all I'm saying is now, so what I'm trying to say is that now I'm looking at a subsystem, which itself is macroscopic. And on this macroscopic subsystem, particle number is able to fluctuate. So the subsystem has a condensate density, which is so much. Okay? You'll come to the rest of it in just a bit. So this has told us that the subsystem has a certain condensate. But there is more than that. Yes?
So in calculating this, is the state defined just within this cell? The state, this one?
Yeah.
This is defined, so there are a couple of points here. One, the point I'm trying to make is, if I take a subsystem in which the number of particles is fluctuating, right? So in this subsystem, suppose from the very beginning, I had done the problem in a grand canonical ensemble. I would have found that this expectation value for that subsystem is non-zero, is this. This is a trivial statement that if the total system, so this is now within a cell, this is being evaluated within a cell. Okay? So within a cell, the number fluctuates, and that allows me to get a finite condensate. But what I want to say is, in order for the system to have a BEC in the entire system, it requires more than that. So the BEC in the full system requires two things. It requires not only BEC in each subsystem, in each macroscopic subsystem, but also are certain correlations, which I'm going to now explain what they are. Phase correlations between distant subsystems. Okay, so let me define psi of R, the same field operator, as square root, this is for the, this is say within the cell, as N0 e to the I theta. Okay, theta is a phase.
So what I'm trying to say is that I'll raise it up. What I'm trying to say is that this expectation value for the subsystem, so this is within, say, some cell, say the ith cell, is the condensate in the cell, is the amplitude of that in the cell times a phase. Okay, so each block here will have some amplitude and a phase. So let me denote the phase with an angle. So each block here has some amplitude, and let's say I denote there is a phase here. You know, it's some variable which lives in the xy plane and it points in different directions. And the BEC requires that there be certain correlations between these phase vectors. And if I go back to this expression that I had for the total condensate, then you can show that I can write that, so if I go back to this kind of a correlation function, which is describing the correlation between these field operators in different cells, then what you will get is A0 dagger A0 is 1 over M sum over IJ AI0 dagger AJ0. And really what I care about are the long distance correlations. So this is, I'm going to write each AI0 dagger if I look at this correlator, I will get 1 over m and then 1 over omega over m from that factor out front, sum over ij integral dri drj psi dagger ri psi rj. And that, if I give say that at long distances, most of the contribution is coming from long distances. So most of the contribution is not from within the cell. Within the cell, it's a small number. It's coming from intercell. Then I can write this as psi dagger ri, psi dagger rj, sorry, psi rj separately. And each of them is the condensate value, which is n0 over omega square root e to the I theta. This one is n0 over omega square root e to the minus I theta. And when I do that, and I put it all together, from here I will get the volume term within a cell, which is omega over m. This is another omega over m. And if I add it all up, everything will cancel, and I will get n0, which is what I wanted. Okay, so the key point is that needed the different cells to have the same phase. Okay, so let me emphasize again what I mean here. Let's raise this a bit. Okay. Let's see. Can you all see the bottom? Maybe I should bring that up. Now I want to say this slowly again. What we have done is we have taken the big system, which has a fixed number of particles, n. Because I can't define these expectation values of these operators in a fixed number system, I'm breaking it up into cells. Okay. Now each cell will have a condensate in each cell. And the amount of condensate will be that n0 over m. That's the volume, that's the number in each cell. But more than that, this object, psi, either psi or psi dagger, has an amplitude which is, let's say, n0 over omega. Okay, this quantity, I'm able to define it, first of all, because I'm defining it within a cell. So it clearly has number fluctuation. It has some amplitude. But more than that, it has a phase. It has a phase. And what I'm trying to get at is another very key characteristic of the BEC is that the phase of this order parameter in the different cells has to be coherent, has to be correlated. If I had not put in the phase there to be independent of R, right? I've made a very important assumption as I did that evaluation. I wrote down what I'm supposed to write is there should have been some R index. Here is the amplitude of creating a particle at site R, right? I did not put any R in the condensate density because it's uniform. But what about the phase? The phase could have had a value which is different from point to point. And what you see from that summation is that if I had these thetas which depended on different points, I would have gotten phase cancellations between these different phases. And these phase cancellations would have led to a result which would not have been N0. The only reason after summing up all those terms, I got N0 is because the phase of the condensate in the different cells was identical. So the system was phase coherent on a long range scale. So the phase here is coherent in the superfluid phase or in the BEC. The phase of the condensate is the same everywhere. And this is, of course, a statement which is in the perfect situation at zero temperature. Yeah, one second. Yeah.
Count the number of condensate particles in a certain cell. But like, if we specify that this particle is in a condensate, we specify its momentum. So it means that it's like uniformly distributed along all this, like all over space. So how can we specify like number of condensate particles in a certain cell?
Yeah. So what I'm trying to say is that Here is my system, and I have a BEC in the whole, it's a k equal to zero state. It's a uniform state in the whole system, right? And now I'm saying the following. Maybe this is another way to express what I did here. So this is my big volume with n particles, right? And I have a condensed state in the momentum equal to zero, which means it's a uniform state. Now I go and look at some small volume, and I count how many particles are there in that volume in the zero momentum state.
We can't, can we define, like if we know that the particle has momentum zero, then we don't know anything about its position, right?
Yeah, we can go and just look at n of k. I can look at the momentum distribution on any scale, right? So I can go and look at the momentum distribution in this state, in this region, right? And I can look at how many atoms there are in that volume in that zero momentum state. And you'll find that the condensate is essentially dictated by the volume. It will be n, it's a uniform condensate, right? So the number here will be n0 over the volume, the number of pieces I've broken it into. But that's not the important point. The important point is that the phase of the condensate. So the crucial point is that the condensate is a complex wave function. So the condensate, we have so far been thinking about the condensate as number of particles in the momentum equal to zero state. And what I'm trying to tell you is that it's more than just the number in that state. This condensate wave function psi is actually complex. So this is a complex wave function . It has an amplitude which is n0 e to the I theta. Okay, so this is the amplitude, and this is the phase. And I'll just come to your question in a bit. So that's the amplitude, and that's the phase. And And the point about this quantity, psi r prime, at r minus r prime, it going to this psi square, also implies that there is a long-range phase coherence. That implies that theta of r is, you know, correlated with theta at r prime. Okay, question?
Is this whole analysis done at zero or non-zero temperature or and with or without interruptions?
So this is, in principle, as I said, this correlator can be defined at any temperature for any interacting system. Okay, you're just, the interactions come in the brackets. What are these brackets over? So these brackets are over the interacting many-body ground state. If it's at finite temperature, then the brackets are over the full ensemble. Okay, yes?
When you do this integral, how can you say that the close-range correlations won't matter so much?
Yeah, no, they do matter, but it's,
yeah.
They do matter, but partly there are many, many more terms at large distances. So it's that is just adding to
but
your.
You know that the close range won't be so large that they will play a significant role.
Right. So as I said, even if they were the same cell, this would be the largest term, right? The same cell.
Okay.
Even the same cell contributes only so much, but it's the fact that you have many terms at the boundary that end up contributing a lot. Okay. More questions? I hope you're getting the spirit of the discussion is that the condensate is a complex wave function. The magnitude of that is telling us about the condensate density. How many particles are in this k equal to zero state? And then the other part of that complex wave function is the phase. And that is a variable which could fluctuate from point to point. But if it did fluctuate, then in that integral over there, I would have had a theta of r and a theta of r prime. And on average, these would have just added up to zero. But by having theta of r equal to theta of r prime, I'm picking up a large contribution from all those terms, and I get a number of order n zero. So to get n zero requires that the system have long-range phase coherence.
I mean, flick over very randomly, but with a small fluctuation.
Yeah,
over the
yeah. So I will come to that. So at this point, I have discussed a perfect situation at zero temperature.
So maybe a question, kind of. The way I visualize the fact that, I mean, you just don't have the long range, the contributions from large situations are the biggest. And you can think of this like a matrix, and you're taking the diagonal, and the diagonal doesn't contribute much. Most of the stuff is actually away from the diagonal if the matrix is big.
So,
but
you know, the terms are of order one. That is the difference. If you typically have some interactions, they will interact only at short distances. This is a very special correlation coming from this long-range order. So it doesn't just happen here, even with spin order. When you look at spin-spin correlations, the fact that you have long-range order means if I know what the spin is doing at r equal to zero, I can exactly predict what it will do at r equal to infinity. If it was zero temperature, it's perfectly correlated. If it's finite, if it's a little higher temperature, okay, the ordering is reduced, but I still know what the spin is doing. That's long-range order. That's the same as rigidity. Like, you know the position here, you know the position far away. Now, what you're replacing those concepts with is phase order. So I'm trying to emphasize that we think too much of the condensate as this macroscopic occupation of one state, all these particles piling up. But it's actually more subtle. The real physics of the BEC is that the phase, the complex wave function, that phase is what is correlated over long distances. Not just that there is some number. Of course, you need that, but it's the ordering of the phase. Okay, now let me come to your question about finite temperature. So let's move this. Before I come to the finite temperature, I want to just say one more thing here, is the following. That, so right now I'm at zero temperature. And the ground state is, can you hear an echo? So I'm going to stop drawing these cells and just look at points, but...
you can turn down the volume over there, I think.
So at zero temperature,
hello? Okay. At zero temperature, can you still hear me?
I am receiving your audio feed. I will look into the room speakers for you. You can continue.
Okay. Okay. So at zero temperature, we said that the, so we have said, we've reached the following conclusion, that there is long range phase correlation, or let me use the word correlation. But the question is, which direction does this phase pick? It is a, it has this rotational symmetry. It has, so the phase has U1 symmetry. It's a complex number. It can lie anywhere on this plane, on this xy plane. And the Hamiltonian has that symmetry. If I were to rotate my A vectors by e to the I theta, because they come in A dagger A, the energy would be the same. But the ground state now is going to break this symmetry. So the ground state so psi goes to psi into the I theta. So it has this symmetry. Ground state breaks this U1 gate symmetry. And you can see it has infinite choices. It will pick some direction in the ground state and then develop this kind of long range order. So this is one of the possible
choices for the phases in the ground state.
What do you exactly mean by the ground state phase, the symmetry?
Again, the same story as in the case of spins. The fact that, so we have realized that the ground state must have, or this condensate must have long range phase coherence. That means if the phase at one point is this way, the phase at a very distant cell also is the same way. But which is that way? There are all possible choices for the phase sitting on the circle to pick any of those directions. The choosing of the phase to point in any one of them then breaks that symmetry. And again, it's the same story. Remember, as I said, all these choices have to be degenerate. And the energy doesn't care which of these ground states you pick. But the system in the infinite system limit will choose one of them.
Quantum mechanics of multiplying the state by a phase?
So the fact that this is happening to a macroscopic ground state with many particles, it means that the particles sitting here and the particles sitting there are in the same, have the same coherent phase between them.
So at the level of state vectors, the state vector which corresponds to a different phase will not be obtained from a state vector, from the ground state corresponding to a different phase, just by multiplying by e to the I. There's going to be something more complicated, which is orthogonal to the previous.
Yes, but it's a property of the ground state of this system, the many-body ground state. So at the level of, so what I'm trying to say is at this level, when I look at psi dagger of R, so I think another way to see this is, suppose I look at something like this. I don't care about the amplitude so much. I can write this as N0 e to the I theta R minus theta R prime. And I'm looking at this kind of correlator.
Yeah, but for example, if when we have the non-interacting bulk gas, that then sort of the ground state is unique. So how can we have a continuum of ground states?
Even for the ground state, it's unique in the sense it all went into the same eigenstate, right? But what I'm saying is that eigenstate actually had further degrees of freedom, which up to now we have so. So, you know, the point is, if my ground state is always phase correlated, I can just call that phase to be zero. It's just no special number, right? If everything is pointing up, I can just as well call that theta to be zero. It's when there are fluctuations that it starts to matter. Okay, and that brings me to the situation at finite temperatures. So here is now T not equal to zero. So let us write down the ground state. The ground state is a situation where the order parameter has the same phase at every point. This axis here is x, some spatial axis. I'm looking at my condensate now spread out in the whole system, and I'm asking what is the phase at different points. The system has broken this U and gate symmetry, and let's say picked one direction, up. So now all the bosons will point in the same direction. By point, I mean the complex wave function will have the same phase, theta. Okay, is that clear? I'm using the word phase in two different ways. It's not the state of matter. We call that also a phase. Here it's the angle of the wave function. It all points in the same direction. And then if I go to finite temperature, so this is at zero temperature, and if I go to finite temperatures, then these things are going to start to oscillate. And just like the phonon case or the spin wave case, they will oscillate, you know, around this axis. and they will generate, you know, the analog of phonons, like that, or down and so on. But these will be the analog of phonons, and you can call them phase fluctuations. Which are the analog of phonons. Okay, questions?
But it's also a zero temperature, but it includes weak interactions. Will they also oscillate?
Will they also oscillate?
Yeah.
Okay, so the question is, at zero temperature, if you include interactions, will they also oscillate? And the answer is yes. Okay, that's a little more difficult answer, but a little more difficult question. And the point is that you can have these fluctuations would be called thermal phase fluctuations. Okay? But at zero temperature also you can have phase fluctuations and they would be called quantum phase fluctuations. We will see that example very soon in the next, in the Bose-Hubbard model.
So for interactionless system at zero temperature, how can you detect this phase?
Yeah, so I will come to that. I will come to that. But let's first at least understand this. Is everybody clear about, yes?
I'll ask my question again. So at zero temperature, or in other words, is there a unique ground state of the Bose-Einstein condense of our interacting or non-interacting system, or is there a continuum of ground states?
There are, so at the answer to your question is there are a continuum of ground states. And the continuum of ground states are defined by the same condensate density, n over omega. The same condensate density, but different values of these phases. So I could have a ground state like this. I could also have another ground state where, so it has U1 symmetry. So I could pick any point on the circle. Let's say another one could be like this. Okay, where the phases are all pointing in the horizontal direction.
Okay, but when we did the non-interacting Bose gas, we saw that there is a unique ground state, not a continuum ground state, which corresponds to all the particles having zero momentum.
No, that's not really true. That we were only in. It depends on now. In the the point is when we were looking at the non-interacting or weakly interacting system, we were talking about a situation where we ignored the phase degree completely. We were only asking about how is the condensate depleted. And that is a good question when the condensate is large. Okay, so the reason we can ignore the phase discussion is because the amplitude is so big, it's so stiff, the system is so stiff that there are hardly any phase fluctuations. So the question that was just asked is, can we have phase fluctuations at zero temperature? And the answer is, yes, you can. Once you start reducing the condensate density, like we did in helium, the amplitude is becoming smaller. Now the phase fluctuations are going to turn up. So at that point, even at zero temperature, the ground state will start to have the effects of these quantum phase fluctuations, coming from the fact that the condensate density has dropped. Okay, so let us look now at a very extreme situation where the condensate density can be pushed all the way to zero. Okay. So if you have more questions, we should still continue to discuss it because this concept is really
the most subtle out of the three systems I wanted to look at, the crystal, the magnet, and the one we are talking today, the superfluid. Maybe it's useful to consolidate the whole picture, and then I can move to this situation where we push the condensate to zero. So let's just summarize the whole thing. We have the Bose system. We have the magnet. And we have the crystal. And let me make a table here. I have the disordered state. I have a little chalk today. I have the disordered state. Ordered. Broken symmetry. Okay, so I'm going to look at various characterizations. The disordered state, that's just normal liquid or gas. The ordered state is the BEC. The further characterization, the broken symmetry, is a U1 gauge symmetry. The Goldstone modes are the oscillations of those phases, which are the longitudinal phonons. And the rigidity is something I will show you a nice YouTube video on this. It is the superfluid density. And so also called phase rigidity. And that refers to the fact that the ground state has a certain long-range order of these phases. It is rigid, which means it does not like those phases to be turned around. And if you try to turn it around here and there, it costs some energy. And the energy is essentially increased. So here's the ground state. Everything is pointing up. If I look at a small excited state, I force the system to have a certain phase on the boundaries. This is forced, externally forced. Then my phases respond to that by turning. And this energy that I get, E of theta, by applying that twist, goes like half rho s gradient of theta square. And rho s is called the phase rigidity. And it is also measurable in an experiment through what is called the superfluid density. Okay, and the defects in these states, which I will come to tomorrow, are vortices. The analog in the magnet is the disordered phase is a paramagnet. The ordered phase is a ferromagnet or an antiferromagnet. Here it is spin rotational. symmetry. And the analog of the phonons are these magnons. And the analog of phase rigidity is spin rigidity, spin stiffness. And you can have defects again. You can have domain walls. We didn't discuss this in too much detail, but I will put it here for completeness. This is in the Ising model. You can have vortices in the XY model. And you can have what are called hedgehogs. Do you know what a hedgehog is? It's that animal, you try to poke it and it gets these spikes sitting on a sphere. It's that kind of a defect. And that is what you get in the O3 Heisenberg models. And for the crystals, you have a liquid, you have a crystal, and you can have the symmetry, which is broken, is continuous translational symmetry. And the magnon analog are phonons, both longitudinal and shear modes. And spin stiffness, that is shear rigidity or shear modulus. I think it's called shear modulus. A liquid has bulk modulus, but a solid only has the shear modulus. And the corresponding to the defects here are these dislocations. So what you thought were boring dislocations in a crystal are actually topological defects. So that kind of gives you the total picture and integrates all these different systems we have been looking at. Okay. Okay, so the next thing I want to do is to look at a model of bosons where the interactions are really tuned to beyond what could be done for helium-4. So that's bosons in optical lattices. So what is done in these are experiments which can be done. Yes, question?
In the Bose system, you have long phonons?
Longitudinal.
Longitudinal phonons. Okay.
Sorry, all those longs mean longitudinal.
Okay, but how do you know, you didn't actually work out the dispersion relation, right?
Well, we did the weakly interacting Bose gas, right? And we found that the K-square dispersion became a linear dispersion. Those are the collective Bogoliubov modes. And that's exactly these bosons, these phonons. Question?
No.
Yeah.
Okay, but when we were doing the interacting, we were at zero temperature, right?
Yes, so we were at zero temperature.
So we broke the symmetry by putting a potential. By turning on the interactions, in this case, instead of turning on the temperature.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand. Ask again.
For the longitudinal phonons on the Bose system condensate, we found them by turning on the weakly interaction. So in the other cases, we found the longitudinal in between our modes by turning on the temperature by bracket.
Okay, yeah. That's a good point. So what he's asking is that we have actually just found the modes to for a zero temperature situation for these excitations. But the point is, what were those excitations? They were the new bubblable quasi-particles, right? So what we showed was that there is a ground state which was defined by, you know, this destruction operator acting on psi to be zero. That was the ground state. These bubblable quasi-particles had that linear dispersion. The point is, now, with such a dispersion, if I were to calculate something like go to finite temperatures, I'm going to excite these bubblable quasi-particles. And they will be having this linear dispersion, and that will give us the specific heat, which will go like T cubed and so on. But actually, you can show the connection more. What you guys are asking are a very important question, which is, how do we connect these order parameter fluctuations to sound, to density? And that can also be done, but I'm going to skip that right now. So it turns out you can write down, so sound, as we know, or phonons, as we know, are density fluctuations. And at the same time, I'm talking about order parameter and its fluctuations. But you can write down the density operator, and when you have a condensate, you can show that the density operator fluctuations are the same as the order parameter fluctuations in the presence of a condensate. It's a more subtle point, and I'm not going into that here. Okay, so what is done in these experiments is to generate more control over interaction physics. So what you have is, what they do is they can put a periodic potential. So here is some periodic potential. And this is generated using lasers. Okay, this is generated using lasers. You put two mirrors and make a standing wave. And in the standing wave, some sinusoidal potential, now you start putting atoms in. And the atoms interact with this laser field through their dipoles. And these atoms are going to try to tunnel from one side to another. So there will be some tunneling. And you can put either fermions or bosons. But right now, let's just assume that they are bosonic atoms. So these bosons can tunnel from one site to another. They can also interact when they are at the same site. There is some interaction potential U. Okay. Exactly how are these potentials related to the periodic potential? That is something I will work out later. I will give you exact expressions of the tunneling in terms of the wave eigenstates in a periodic potential. Okay, so I will come to that tomorrow. But today I want to just say that, motivated by such experiments, you can write down a Hamiltonian for these bosons, which looks like this. Okay. And you can also put a chemical potential to control the total number of particles in the system. So let's look at each term. This term, let me put nearest neighbor hopping. This is a tunneling term for nearest neighbor sites. This I'm going to take to be greater than zero, so it's a repulsion between bosons on the same site. And mu controls the total number. Okay, so this model has all the physics we have been talking about, from the non-interacting to helium to more. And the way you can see that is, if I turn off U, this is just a one-body potential, and you can diagonalize it.
it will give you something like a cosine band. If I go into momentum space, I will get a cosine band, epsilon k. Here is k equal to 0. And in the absence of any interaction, all the bosons will sit in that state. Now I can turn on U and make it small. Well, it will start to deplete the condensate, just like the weakly interacting gas we looked at. I can keep cranking up U. And the question is, what happens? So this is something you will work out in detail today in the tutorial. But let me just give you a few pointers here. So in general, this is a very hard problem, and we can't solve it analytically for all values of u, but we can say a few things. So let me just assume that I take a lattice, and let's say I have fixed the number of sites to be something, n, and the number of bosons, let me also take that to be n. Okay, I'm taking this special case. And let us make U bigger and bigger. So this is the limit we understand. This is, and I'm going to first discuss everything at zero temperature, because that itself is very interesting. So this, what I'm plotting here is N0, the condensate density, which is, let me plot the condensate density as a function of U. So I'm starting out here. N0 is equal to the total density. This is N over V, or N plus number of bosons by number of sites. And this will be 1 here, because that's how I picked it. And then as I increase U, we expect this to go down, because some of the particles are getting excited into the higher momentum states. But at some point, this model will show the following behavior. And this is what you will calculate in the afternoon, that it will go to 0 at some critical value of U over T, or U over T critical. Okay. And at this point, the system has gone. Here it was a superfluid. Here it is, it has gone into some kind of a non-superfluid phase. We call it a Mott insulator. Okay, and if you ask, what is the physics behind this? Of course, you know, the condensate has gone to 0, but what, in terms of the phases that we were discussing today, what has happened? What has happened is, here, let me describe the order parameter with a magnitude and an angle. Okay, so here is my order parameter, which has a magnitude and e to the I theta, an angle. So let me just try to sketch for you the ground states at a couple of points. So here, at very small u, the ground state looks like this. Everything is phase coherent, and the magnitude here is N0. Sorry, that's square root N0. OK? That's the magnitude of the order parameter. When I come here, the magnitude is now going down. OK? That's one thing, because N0 is going down. But in addition, the phase in the ground state itself is starting to fluctuate. Like that. It's not totally wild like that, but I just want to give you the idea that there are phase fluctuations in the condensate, phase fluctuations at t equal to 0 in the ground state. Okay, so that's very profound. These are quantum phase fluctuations. These are quantum. And why is it happening? It's happening because the amplitude is becoming smaller and smaller, and as a result, the phase, which is the conjugate variable, is starting to rotate. And ultimately, at some point here, you destroy this phase coherence across the system. So you're seeing that the superfluid is a manifestation of a long-range phase coherence, and in the Mott state, you have destroyed that. That's really the physics behind this transition. What you will do in the afternoon is a baby version of this problem. And by baby version, I mean we will do a mean field theory, which will ignore the phase fluctuations. But it will still have the amplitude going to 0. So I want you to keep that in mind, because it's not the full solution. Okay, so how do we do a mean field theory? And so the mean field theory we will do is actually very different from what you might have seen previously. Typically, when you have a Hamiltonian, you diagonalize the kinetic energy term. And you say, OK, the interactions are small. We will treat that in some mean field way. But now I'm going to do something different. I'm going to take the interacting Hamiltonian in the site basis, and I can diagonalize that completely. That's like a classical term. And I will actually do perturbation theory in the hopping rather than in the interaction. So the site basis will be my unperturbed basis, and then I will see what tunneling adds to that. So this thing, AI dagger, so here let me say, start with U term as the unperturbed term. And you can see that is very easy. If hopping was 0, I gave you a bunch of bosons and I said minimize the energy, you know what to do. If I have, mu is my control parameter, so I'm changing the density. I don't put any place, I don't put double occupancy. I just keep one boson per site. That's the minimum energy. Then if I keep increasing mu, I add more particles. I now have to populate some wells with 2 bosons, right? And then I have to keep adding till I saturate 2, and then I have to go to 3 bosons per site. So that Hamiltonian is trivial if hopping was 0. But now I put hopping in. And this term, AI dagger AJ, I'm going to write as the average this thing minus AI dagger AJ. So this is the mean field approximation. I'm going to give expectation values to just one of these field operators. And we know what that is. That is our order parameter. AI dagger is equal to AI is equal to psi. Right, this is the superfluid order parameter. And I'm going to assume this is real. So no phase fluctuations. Okay. So as I already warned you, the real transition has a lot of these quantum phase fluctuations. It won't capture that. But nevertheless, it will capture this order parameter, this condensate density going to zero. So it contains some parts which are quite relevant. So once I make this assumption, my Hamiltonian can be written. The mean field Hamiltonian is sum over I H mean field. And H, so this becomes a sum over just site Hamiltonians. And HI mean field is this, minus T psi AI dagger plus AI plus T psi square plus U over 2. I should have a mu, okay. Ni minus 1 minus mu ni. This is my Hamiltonian. Okay, I'm almost done. I just need 5 more minutes. Okay, so I use a very different basis from what you might be familiar with. I'm going to go into the site basis and write down in the number of bosons per site. That's going to be my basis state. So I have 0 bosons at a site, 1 boson, 2 bosons, and so on. I can truncate this at some point. Okay, so this is the matrix you will construct, but you can see from here right away that there are some diagonal terms. Here, 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 and so on. And the diagonal terms will just be these T psi square, the U term, and the mu term. So let's write down one of them. At no particles, I just get T psi square. When I have 1 particle, I will get a mu term, T psi square minus mu. When I have 2 particles, that's when I first see the effect of U. So at this point, I get T psi square minus 3 mu plus 3, no, sorry, minus 2 mu. I have 2 particles right now, plus U. Okay, and so on. And then I have off-diagonal terms. The hopping allows me to create a particle at a site. So you'll fill up these terms here. And let me just write down one of them. This is minus T. This one here is minus T. Minus T times, I should have psi. T times psi. Right? And 0 cannot go to 2, but 1 can go to 2. So I will get terms here and so on. So in any case, you can construct such a matrix, and you can see it is off diagonal. It has all these hopping terms, which is destroying the classical problem. And in a way, that's what we are after. It's adding the quantum mechanics. Is everybody clear how to construct that matrix? Because you'll have to do it in the afternoon. Yeah.
I'm not sure about the 0, 1.
0, 1. So here,
you look at that term. You know that you're calculating these things. Hi between states n and n.
Okay.
That's what you're trying to do. Okay, so that's what you put together, and you can see that it's the t term which will connect particles which have are different by one. Question.
So the plan is to diagonalize the full Hamiltonian by diagonalizing each hi because they all commute at different sites.
Yes.
This is the
yes.
idea.
Exactly. They all commute at different sites. You've destroyed the long range character actually by doing this. So that's the mean field approximation. This is not really the structure of the ground state. But nevertheless, if you do that, you can then find the lowest eigenvalue E0, which will depend on psi. Right? Psi is unknown. So you would start by fixing U and mu. These are your input parameters. U and T. We can use T to be just equal to 1. That's our unit. So you can, for a given value of the repulsion and a given mu, mu controls the density, but you're not putting in particles. You're just changing this parameter mu. And by doing that, you get this Hamiltonian, you diagonalize it, you will get a ground state energy E0, which will depend on psi. And now you have to minimize this. So E0 versus psi will look like this, some shape like this. And you want to find that psi star, which minimizes the energy. And that tells you this is the value of the order parameter under these conditions, under these interaction conditions. And when you now plot it, psi as a function of u, you will see that it goes to 0 at some critical value of u. Okay, so that's really beautiful, that from this very simple theory, you have managed to calculate something very hands-on, and it shows this behavior of a vanishing order parameter. And then, what is even more interesting is that you can plot it in this way. You can start to get phase diagrams. So the next step is, once you understand the procedure, you can put together a phase diagram which says, in the plane of u and mu, what are the phases? So you can look at psi as a function of mu. This is for a fixed u. And what you'll see is when the chemical potential, as it is being increased from 0, you are adding particles into the system. The system is superfluid. But then, when you hit a particular value of mu, and you have one particle per site, you will see that psi goes to 0, then it has some shape like this. So this is something you want to try in the afternoon when you're playing with it. So it goes through superfluid, Mott insulator, superfluid, Mott insulator. And you can calculate the density. And I told you mu controls the density, but what is the density? In the ground state, AI dagger AI in the ground state, and you'll see this number . So this is 1, 2. You'll see that the density is rising. Then it remains 1 for this range. Then again it rises and remains 1, like 2, and so on. So this is a function of mu over T. So what you're seeing is in the superfluid state, the density doesn't just stabilize at one per particle. It is fluctuating. It's changing. And actually, the compressibility, which is a response function of the system, is dN d mu. You may remember that from some statistical physics, that the compressibility is delta N by delta mu, 1 over N squared. It's the change in rho, let me write rho here, change in rho with mu. So in the superfluid, you're able to get a finite compressibility. And that's the correct result, because a superfluid has four non-modes, it has a finite compressibility. But when you hit the Mott insulator, the system freezes with one particle in each well. And now when you try to change the density, it resists that because of the strong repulsion. Then again, you manage to force it out of that by adding more particles. You're now going into two in some of the wells. So long as all the wells don't have two per site, on average, the density can again fluctuate. And then you're here. And then you hit a commensurate filling where you have two bosons per site. Again, the system freezes into a Mott insulator. So you should be able to see that. And then the punchline, the last part, would be to go into this these axes, where you look at mu over u and t over u, and map out these contours where so these are contours where psi is non-zero here and psi is zero here. Okay, remember that was how psi was varying as a function of mu for a fixed u. So now you use u and mu, change both of them, and plot those regions where psi is zero and psi is non-zero. And this is then the phase diagram, Mott insulator with rho, average rho, equal to 2, average rho equal to 1. These are called the Mott lobes. And this region here is the superfluid.
What's the word? Mott?
Lobes. Sorry, I should write that. My handwriting sometimes. L-O-B-E-S. It's a lobe. Okay. So while you're doing this, you should try to convert these pictures into what you expect, that as you sit at a certain density, you're in a Mott insulator, you increase the tunneling. You can think of this axis as either reducing interaction or increasing tunneling. As you increase the tunneling, you go into a superfluid phase. Okay? And on the other hand, if you are sitting at a particular tunneling, let's say somewhere here, you have very few particles in the system, it will be a superfluid. When the chemical potential increases and you get on average one particle per site, if the interaction is high enough, you go into a Mott insulator. And then again, it melts and goes into a superfluid and then a Mott insulator and so on. I'm saying melting, I should say, it's all quantum effect at zero temperature. So this is the full phase diagram at zero temperature. Okay. Any questions? Yes?
What is the physical meaning of having those two more different Mott insulators?
The physical difference is that if you look at these wells, here you have one particle per site. Here you have these wells, and now you have two particles per site.
So in principle, there are like infinite?
There are infinite number of wells. I mean, infinite number of lobes. Yeah. Because you can keep adding more and more bosons at a site. But what you will see is that the size of these lobes starts shrinking. because it's much easier to destroy because of the Bose coherence factor. That plays an important role. It's easier to destroy the higher density loads. So you should check it out in your simulation if you can go that high. So here I wrote it down for up to 2. If you just leave it at 2, you will get just 2 lobes, but you can go to, you can put in more terms in that and increase the number of particles per site in the Hamiltonian.
Another question, like, why do we have a potential energy n times n minus 1?
This is just, you can construct interactions of different forms, okay? This is just one form of this. What you're trying, this is how the original, when you have bosons, there will be some density-density interaction between the bosons. So what you really care about is just an NI-NI term. That's saying that there is an interaction on site. Okay, the minus one is irrelevant. That's just some constant shift. But more importantly, this Hamiltonian has only on-site repulsion. You can have more complex interactions where you have a next neighbor, third neighbor, and so on. But in these cold atomic gases, luckily, they can engineer interactions which are just very, very local. So it is not an approximation for some of these optical lattices. You can actually engineer just an on-site repulsion. Because these are not Coulomb interactions. These are coming from a much shorter range contact interactions. Any other questions? Should we break for lunch? OK, yeah, see you there.